I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Yesterday, federal prosecutors charged Pennsylvania Congressman Democrat Shaka Fattah and four associates in a 29-count indictment, including racketeering conspiracy, money laundering, and bribery. This is the result of an investigation that is focused on Fattah's run for mayor of Philadelphia back in 2007. Here's Leslie Caldwell of the Justice Department outlining the indictment.
As charged in the indictment, Congressman Fattah and his associates undertook a wide-ranging conspiracy that involved bribery, concealment of unlawful campaign contributions, theft of charitable contributions, and theft of federal funds, all to advance their own interests. When elected officials betray the trust and confidence that's placed in them by the public, the Department of Justice will do everything in our power to ensure that they are held accountable.
Fattah, who has served in Congress for 20 years, stepped down yesterday as the ranking member of the powerful House Appropriations Subcommittee, and he said this.
This is not the flake game, all right? This is a normal issue of which there are allegations after a very long-running eight-year investigation. But I'll stand by my previous statement that I've never been involved in any wrongdoing, any unlawful activity, and any misappropriation of federal funds. And it's obviously going to be important to my constituents that this matter not be a distraction in terms of my work, and I'm going to try not to have it be a distraction.
Well, joining us is Jeremy Roebuck. He covers the federal courts for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and he joins us to explain what's in this indictment. Jeremy, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. So this goes back to when Shaka Fattah was running for mayor of Philadelphia. He did lose in that race, but nonetheless, it goes back to that bid for office here in Philadelphia. What have the feds charged?
Well, basically, they've charged him with a number of schemes, including one involving campaign finance from that election run, the schemes to line his own pockets, pay off campaign debts, things like that, through misusing money from various nonprofits he controlled and federal grants he was able to steer to those nonprofits.
Now, he – and this is what the feds allege, that he got something like $1 million to help fund this campaign back in 2007. First of all, who did he get this money from? In the indictment, he's described as Person D.
Yeah, that's probably the largest single scheme in the whole indictment. The money, the $1 million loan, which the federal authorities have described as an illegal campaign loan, came from Al Lord, who is a former chief executive of the student loan lender Sallie Mae. Because it was over a spending cap from the city of Philadelphia, the federal allegation is that Fattah and his campaign workers channeled that money through various organizations, before it got to the campaign. And then when it came time to pay it off, they alleged that Fattah's campaign drew money from various nonprofits, again, channeling it through other organizations to get it back to Lord.
And we should just say that there have been campaign caps in Philadelphia. So this large – if this $1 million, way over this campaign cap.
Way over. I mean, the cap is somewhere in the thousands of dollars. And it's interesting to note that that 2007 year was the first year that those city campaign caps were in place.
Interesting. So we're talking about, I guess, after the campaign was over, Shaka Fattah allegedly owed this person something like $600,000.
Right.
And you mentioned how some of this money was allegedly funneled back and forth. We're talking about what, federal money, money through charities?
It's a bit of both. Some of the money came through federal grants that went to a nonprofit that the congressman had set up years ago to fund scholarships for underprivileged kids. And then some of the money also came from charitable donations to that same nonprofit from, of all things, the charitable arm of Sallie Mae.
And who was, I guess, in charge of the money back and forth? I mean, is there evidence that Shaka Fattah was, in a sense, in charge of all this, making all these kinds of decisions?
The suggestion in the indictment says that he was aware of and, was kind of directing some of this. But the people actually making the moves of the money included some longtime staffers that had worked for the congressman in his congressional career and then had moved on to kind of run some of these charities.
And are these some of the four people that have been indicted?
There were four others charged alongside Fattah yesterday, including Bonnie Bowser, who was the chief of staff in his district office, Karen Nicholas, who formerly worked for the congressman in his D.C. office but went on to run one of these nonprofits. She was one of the primary movers, the feds allege, in moving this money around. Also charged was another longtime friend of Fatah, Robert Brand, whose wife was at one time worked for Fatah.
And the other person charged is a guy named Herbert Vetterman.
Uh-huh.
Who's he?
He is a former lobbyist and deputy mayor under the Rendell administration when he was mayor of Philadelphia. And after that time, the indictment alleges he was pretty keen on landing an ambassadorship. And so the prosecutors are saying that Mr. Vetterman provided several bribes to the congressman, including money to his son, you know, paying for college for the Fatah family's South African au pair, and then also paying some money for Pocono's house.
So we're talking, at least according to the Justice Department, a quid pro quo here?
Yes, yes. Vetterman's lawyer has responded, you know, they were just friends. You're mistaking, you know, gifts between friends as a bribe.
It seems, at least according to the Justice Department, that Chaka Fatah even was appealing to the Obama administration to get some kind of a position for Vetterman.
Yeah. I mean, the way prosecutors tell it, Fatah really, really worked on behalf of his friend here. There's mention of conversations that Fatah had with President Obama's chief of staff at the time, Rahm Emanuel. And then, you know, at one point, allegedly pressing a letter on behalf of Vetterman into the president's hand at a political function.
Is there any evidence that the Obama administration was interested in this or not? Is that in the indictment at all?
There's no suggestion that they responded in any way. You know, I think the fact that Vetterman was never appointed to an ambassadorship may suggest that it just didn't work out.
Now, what about Chaka Fatah's son?
Chaka Fatah's son was indicted last year in a separate but somewhat connected case involving allegations of tax and bank fraud. In that case, there is a tie to some of the same people in the congressman's inner circle that were charged in this case. But he's got his own legal problems at this point.
But what the feds allege is that Chaka Fatah used some of this money to help pay off or perhaps pay off a student loan for his son.
Yeah, and that's the one link between the case of the congressman and his son. The allegation is that for several years, a former chief of staff for the congressman was paying money to Chaka Fatah Jr. that was used to pay his college loans. The allegation is it was kind of a no-show job. It was never declared on income taxes or anything like that.
Now, a year ago, the former chief of staff for Chaka Fatah, this is a guy named Gregory Naylor, and also a consultant that had worked for Chaka Fatah, I think, and others as well, mm-hmm. in D.C., a guy named Tom Linfeld, both pled guilty to what? And this is about a year ago.
Yeah, and there were two cases. These were the two cases that kind of signaled something big was coming down the road for the congressman. One, Gregory Naylor, who was Fatah's former chief of staff, and then Tom Linfeld, who had worked pretty closely with the congressman on the mayoral campaign and other campaigns. They both pleaded guilty to their roles in that $1 million campaign loan scheme. And, you know, it was only a matter of time, it seemed to many people after that we'd see something coming against the congressman.
Because they pled guilty to this same $1 million loan.
Yes, they, according to the feds and according to their own admissions in court, they played a role in helping channel this money along the way.
I mean, is the thinking that guilty plea or those guilty pleas opened the door to this particular indictment that came down yesterday?
I think it certainly helped. I mean, you know, typically in cases like that, in both cases, both pled to what's called an information where it didn't go to the point where the authorities indicted them. And usually that suggests some form of cooperation or some form of, you know, helping out investigators. So, you know, I think the suggestion there is that perhaps they also provided what information they had.
Now, Chaka Fatah has denied he did anything wrong yesterday. Has that been his approach since all of this?
Yeah, he's really been defiant and very clear that he did nothing wrong in his public statements as this investigation has gone on for years at this point. Every time he speaks, he heavily emphasizes the work he does for scholarships, for education, and science and technology. And, you know, he really would prefer if people were focusing more on that than on these charges.
There is another piece, and it is a bit complicated, but it does involve a vacation home in the Poconos. We were talking about this before going on the air. Can you just give us some of the outlines of that?
Yeah. One of the allegations is that Vetterman provided a bribe in the form of money that was given to Fatah and his wife, a longtime NBC 10 anchor, to secure a mortgage for this vacation home in the Poconos. According to prosecutors, they tried to cover up some of this money by staging it as a sham car sale of the congressman's wife's Porsche. So basically what happened is the money was given as I'm buying this car, but then Fatah's wife allegedly kept the car.
And we're talking about an alleged $18,000 transaction.
Yes.
So what happens next?
Well, the first thing we're going to see is Fatah and his co-defendants have to show up in court for their initial appearances. They were not arrested or taken into custody yesterday when the charges were announced. And they'll schedule those hearings probably sometime next week. And then from there, we'll see where it goes.
And we're talking about the court here in Philadelphia,
yes,
just down
the
street from us.
In Philadelphia.
And does anyone know who the judge is, for instance, in this case?
You know, it's been announced. I believe there's been nothing docketed on the case just yet. So we'll have to keep a close eye on that.
What will you be keeping a close eye on? This has been a long time coming. I should say I think everyone pretty much agrees on that. What will you be looking for then?
I think what will be most interesting is to see what the congressman uses as his defense in this case. He's already signaled that he thinks that this is a personal vendetta that federal authorities have been pursuing against his family. That's been one of his frequent
including
lines.
Including his wife and I guess his son as well.
Yeah, exactly. I think we may see shades of the defense that I mentioned earlier with the lobbyist lawyer who was saying, you know, these were not bribes. These were just gifts between friends. There was no action expected out of these gifts. And the rest of it, we'll see.
Mm. It'll be interesting to see what the four other people charged also, I guess, what their defense will be and how they will approach these allegations.
Yeah. So far, all of the lawyers for the other four that we spoke to yesterday were saying they intend to fight the charges. You know, no one, at least so far, has publicly signaled that they intend to plead guilty or cooperate with the federal investigation. But sometimes as these cases go on, things change.
Were you surprised that this came down yesterday? I remember there was a lot of scurrying in the hallways here when the indictment was announced.
It was a bit of a surprise. Federal authorities kept this pretty close to the vest yesterday. I mean, I think that the fact that they were working on an indictment towards Fatah had been signaled pretty well for years now. But, you know, we were all kind of sitting here thinking, well, is that ever going to come?
Mm. And it did.
And it did.
Well, Jeremy Roebuck, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
No problem.
A very important story here in the Delaware Valley. And again, Jeremy Roebuck covers the federal courts for the Philadelphia Inquirer, talking about yesterday's indictment of Pennsylvania Congressman Democrat Shaka Fatah. We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We'll be talking about Pennsylvania, a Senate race coming up, and it's getting pretty interesting. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoe. Yes, I know the U.S. Senate race in Pennsylvania is more than a year away, but things are getting interesting here in the Commonwealth. Incumbent Republican Pat Toomey is looking for a second term and doesn't face a challenger from inside his party so far. Democrat Joe Sestak declared months ago and has been crisscrossing the state. Meanwhile, Democratic leaders in the state are looking for someone to challenge him. Kathleen McGinty just resigned as Governor Wolf's chief of staff and is thought to be considering a run for the U.S. Senate, taking on Sestak. Joining us to talk about all of this is Thomas Baldino. He's a professor of political science at Wilkes University in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Thomas, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Good morning.
Good morning. Also with us is Mark Nevins, partner and chief creative officer of the Philadelphia-based media and communications firm, The Dover Group. And Mark Nevins, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Nice to be back.
Thomas, we're talking about a race that's not really going to take place for more than a year now. Are we jumping the gun on this?
Probably for the general public.
Right.
The political junkies are definitely into this.
Why are you into this, Tom?
As a political scientist and a resident of Pennsylvania, it would be impossible for me not to be interested in this, partly because of the inter-party struggles that the Democrats are dealing with here. SESTAC, and under normal situation, in normal circumstances, should have the endorsement and full support of the Democratic Party. But because of what he did back in 2010, when he challenged Arlen Specter in the primary, he's engendered the bad feelings of the Democratic Party leadership in the state, and they have been working hard for years. Now, actually, since SESTAC essentially declared almost, it seems like 2 years ago, probably less than that, to find someone to replace him on the ballot in the primary. And it's counterproductive from my perspective. It's just an observer of this, but it's not my call.
No, it isn't. In fact,
a lot of money on this, and it could be better spent in a general election.
In fact, we're hoping to hear from Bob Brady a little bit later in the hour. To you, Mark Nevins, how do you see this inter-party struggle?
We've backed ourselves as a party, as a Democrat. We've backed ourselves into a bit of a corner now because we hamstrung Congressman SESTAC right out of the gate, made it harder for him to raise money. He's a relentless campaigner, so he's doing everything he can. But in the long run, it's hard to raise money when PACs, leadership PACs, national PACs aren't giving because the leadership is saying, hold off until we figure out who we really want in this race. And now they've recruited Katie McGinty into the race, but she's starting behind. Congressman SESTAC already has $2 million plus in the bank. She's starting from probably close to zero. And let's face it, Senator Toomey's got $8 million plus in the bank. So there's a real catch-up game here.
Is it all about money in the final analysis, Mark?
It's never all about money, but it's mostly about money.
Because that's how you, what, get your name out? That's how you do ads?
At the end of the day, for all of the talk about new media and online and digital advertising, it's a TV game. TV is the golden ticket, and if you don't have the money to get your ads on TV in a compelling and significant way, you're giving yourself a poor chance to win.
Well, I'm going to ask you because we kept waiting all this week because we knew we wanted to do the show whether Kathleen McGinty was going to declare or not. She has not. Are we jumping the gun on this, do you think, Mark?
I don't think so.
You think it's imminent?
All of the signals I've seen, people I've talked to, suggest that this is not a matter of if but when.
Let me go back to you, Tom, because Kathleen McGinty ran for governor of Pennsylvania. She ran against the guy that won. In fact, she came in last, and then she worked for him for a while as his chief of staff. What's so appealing about her to the Democratic Party?
Well, one, she is willing to run. And I did a quick count, a rough count, and I came up with seven names of people the Democratic Party floated out there and tried to recruit to campaign against SESTAC. And so they finally found someone in McGinty who is willing to challenge SESTAC in the primary. So, one, they have a candidate who is willing to run. Second, and not insignificantly, she's a woman, and being a woman in this race will help, I believe. And I say that especially if Mrs. Clinton is the Democratic presidential candidate. And so in Pennsylvania, with Clinton at the top of the ticket in 2016, having another woman on the ballot will help the Democratic candidate. That's my feeling on this. And third, she does have some statewide name recognition, which, as Mark was saying, you know, when you're spending a lot of money on TV, it's all about gaining that name recognition so that when voters go into the voting booth, they have someone that they've been able to at least say, oh, I know who that person is, because generally voters don't vote for anyone that they don't know about. So all of those things, I think, factor into McGinty's appeal as someone to challenge SESTAC in the primary.
Well, Mark, let me go back to you because you served as the Pennsylvania Communications Director for Hillary Clinton back in 2008, I guess when she was taking on the current president of the United
States.
Seems
like a long time ago.
I mean, do you see the woman configuration here? Is that appealing, you think?
That's not an insignificant factor for Katie in the primary and the general. Yeah, Katie McGinty in the primary and in the general. Women vote in larger numbers in the Democratic primary and in a general. And if Secretary Clinton is the Democratic nominee, and let's face it, that seems likely, the gender gap in that general election will be even more significant than it is under normal circumstances. In the same way that African Americans turned out in large numbers to vote for President Obama, I suspect women will turn out in large numbers to vote for Secretary Clinton, and that will have a ripple effect down the ticket for somebody like Katie McGinty running against Pat Toomey. It could give her the extra boost she needs to get over that finish line. All you need is 50% plus one. So if that gives her the extra boost, that could be a difference maker.
Well, let me stand up for Joe Sestak here, if I may. I mean, here's a guy who came very close to beating Pat Toomey. This was back in, what, the 2010. So clearly he had a difficult job on his hand. He came pretty close. He declared early. He walked across this state. Mm-hmm. He is talking to the people. And he says to the party leaders, it's not about you. It's about the people. Yep. Isn't that an appealing message,
Mark? It's incredibly compelling. Nobody will work harder than Joe Sestak. Nobody will outwork Joe Sestak. You can work as hard as him, but this is a
not
guy.
Harder.
This is a guy who goes to bed at 2 a.m. and gets up at 5 a.m. and still has more energy than everybody else. He's relentless, which is what allowed him to walk across the state. Mm-hmm. You know, the sort of one percenters of the Democratic Party are calling the shots in a lot of ways, but the people in the rank and file, the people out across the rest of the state, they don't care what the rest of the sort of party leaders say. They've met Joe Sestak, and that is going to be a significant advantage for him. And it'll be up to Katie McGinty in the primary to try and compete with him on that level.
I mean, isn't that the kind of retail politics, Tom, that many people find appealing?
Oh, absolutely. And in the interest of full disclosure, he is relentless, and I saw that personally because he came to my class back in 2010, my seminar on Congress, and in an intense 20 or 25 minutes, he really pitched why he would be a positive force in the Senate for the voters of Pennsylvania, the people of Pennsylvania. It's quite impressive, and he is someone who I think it would be very difficult to outwork. I also like to raise something here that we haven't yet touched on, and that is the importance of turnout in this particular election that in the election of 2010 worked to Sestak's disadvantage. Turnout was really rather low in 2010. And in a year in which the Republican Party did well nationally, picking up 63 seats in the U.S. House and sweeping everything else in the state of Pennsylvania, Sestak only lost by basically 2 points, 51-49. And for Sestak to do that well in a really bad year for Democrats, he should benefit, or any Democratic candidate in the 2016 race should benefit from having a presidential candidate at the top of the ticket in a state that is, registered, has a Democratic registration edge. And so Sestak in a race against Toomey head-to-head should do better, but the point that Mark made earlier, the importance of money, that's going to be difficult for Sestak to overcome unless the party gets behind him if he wins the primary. So that's another factor here that we need to consider, that the importance of turnout, and especially the turnout in a presidential election year.
Let me quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Tom Baldino, professor of political science at Wilkes University in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Also with us, Mark Nevins, partner, the chief creative officer of the Philadelphia-based media and communications firm called the Dover Group. We're getting a little wonky here, also getting a little ahead of ourselves, but nonetheless, some very interesting psychological and political dynamics here in Pennsylvania related to the race for the U.S. Senate. As I mentioned, incumbent Republican Senator Pat Toomey facing a challenge from Congressman Joe Sestak, but looks like the party leaders don't really like Joe Sestak very much. And we're talking about why and some of the political calculations. Also, the fact that it looks like, although it's not official, that the former chief of staff for Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf, Katie McGinty, Kathy McGinty, will probably be jumping in on the race. We want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times if you want to wonk along with us. To you, Mark, we are talking about in Pennsylvania a 1 million registration vote advantage, I believe, for the Democrats in this state. And yet, in many ways, it's still considered a swing state. Is there something about either the candidates or voters in Pennsylvania, especially Democratic voters, that just don't turn out the way that Republicans do?
You know, Tom really hit the nail on the head. It depends on the election year. In presidential election years, Democrats turn out in larger numbers. And in non-presidential election years, they don't. And Republicans turn out pretty consistently at the same level, no matter whether it's a presidential year or a non-presidential year. And as a party, it's our challenge to figure out how to boost our numbers in those non-presidential years, or we're going to continue to get beat every 4 years and try and get it back every 4 years.
What's so interesting to me is and hopefully we'll be hearing from Bob Brady a little bit later in the hour, is just how personal this all is. I mean, the idea, and it should be said that Arlen Specter was a Republican, became a Democrat to run here in Pennsylvania. And I think a lot of voters were kind of turned off by that. And yet the party elders seem to be blaming Joe Sestak. I'm back at you, Mark. But, Tom, I'd like to get a response from you as well.
Yeah, I think you raise a great point, which is that there's a very clear divide between what the rank and file, that is to say the average voter, sees and what the sort of party leaders see. You know, Arlen Specter was someone who worked very closely with Governor Rendell, worked very closely with Senator Casey, worked very closely with a lot of Democratic Party leaders in Philadelphia in particular. That's what made him so effective as a Republican, as a moderate Republican. So when he switched, all of those folks welcomed him with open arms. But the folks on the ground, the folks who vote Democrat on a yearly basis, they didn't know Arlen Specter except as a guy with an R after his name. So there was a distinct difference in the way he was perceived. And Congressman Sestak at that time exploited that to his advantage and beat him fair and square in that primary. There was no question about it. He outworked Senator Specter and he won. And I think that some of the party leaders resented that he didn't step aside for their good friend Arlen Specter. Another problem is that Congressman Sestak is a renegade. He's a guy who marches to the beat of his own drum. He does not listen to anybody at the top of the ticket. He does not listen to anybody leading the party at the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, which is the party committee in Washington, D.C. that oversees all the Senate races. He does not care what they say. He does not care what Governor Rendell has to say. He's doing what he wants to do. And that makes a lot of people uncomfortable.
Well, certainly people at the top. Tom, you want to weigh in on that at all?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with everything that Mark said, but let me provide a little more context just for those who remember what happened back in 2009-10. When Toomey announced that he was going to challenge Specter in that Republican primary for the Senate seat, the immediate response was, oh my, Specter's in trouble. Mm-hmm. Because he had been a moderate in the state that is basically purple, at least it was certainly at that point and still is. It was assumed that Specter would have a difficult time beating Toomey. Toomey at that point was president of Club for Growth, a very conservative organization that then and now continues to operate as an independent force in Republican primaries, advocating for very conservative positions. And the expectation was Toomey would really bang hard on Specter in the primary, and if not unseat him, paint him into a far more conservative corner that might, in Specter's mind, cost him the general election. So the Democratic Party leaders, from the president on down, worked hard to get Specter to change parties. And they committed to Specter that they would clear a path for him. And then Specter changes parties, and then Sestak basically challenges the establishment and throws a monkey wrench into that deal. So, as Mark pointed out, that all led to this resentment against Sestak that lingers to this day. So there you have it.
There you have it. I'm curious, too, and I'll go back to you, Mark Nevins. Does this tell us that people are thin-skinned when it comes to parties and party leadership, that it is personal?
Well, there's certainly an element of personal to it. It's not always just business. There is a personal investment you make in the relationships. A lot of this is relationship driven, and so when those relationships are compromised or a level of assumed trust is violated, people get their feelings hurt, and it's hard to let go of that for some people.
And it seems, I mean, that was such an, this is almost feels like ancient history, but that the Toomey, Sestak, Arlen Specter race, that was so important. I also remember one of the ads that was run that seemed to be Arlen Specter's undoing. I think it was the way he said the word elected.
Allow me to get re-elected.
Yeah, I mean, that seemed to just sort of put the nail in the coffin for him.
The ad makers who made that had unearthed a piece of video from when he switched parties that sort of cemented his party switch, not as an act of courage or principle, but rather political and career expediency. And that kind of thing blew up in a way that became viral even in 2010. And I think you're right. It did end up costing him that election.
And Tom, we're almost having a break here, but I heard you chuckle.
Yes, because that was a very telling moment. And if I may add the political scientist nerdy part of me, you know, the people who turn out in primaries tend to be, on the Republican side, more conservative than the average voter, and on the Democratic side, more liberal than the average voter. And so in that primary in 2010, in which Sestak and Specter went head-to-head, as Mark noted, the very liberal Democratic voters had no great love for Specter, even though he was a more moderate Republican at that time, which there were far more moderate Republicans. Specter became the target of their anger. And it was a close race even with all that. Sestak pulled about 54% of the vote.
Yep. Well, we are reliving a past Senate race, but it has some resonance for today, talking with Tom Baldino and Mark Nevins. And I see from my computer we have Representative Bob Brady waiting in the wings. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We've been talking about a past Senate race here in Pennsylvania and looking ahead to the next one next year. Incumbent Republican Senator Pat Toomey looks like he's going to face a Democratic challenger, certainly is facing him now, former Congressman Joe Sestak, and what looks like a likely run from former Chief of Staff for Governor Wolf, Katie McGinty. And joining us now is Bob Brady. He is a congressman representing the 1st Congressional District here in the city of Philadelphia. Also happens to be the chairman of the city's Democratic Committee. And Bob Brady, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be with you, Marty. How have you been? Okay?
I've been good. Yes, I've been good.
Good for you.
What's your problem with Joe Sestak?
Well, let me take you back a little bit. You know, Joe Sestak beat Kurt Weldon. And he beat Kurt Weldon when he was under some type of cloud, never indicted, but some kind of FBI scrutiny, Kurt and his daughter. And it happened 3, 4, 6 weeks before a primary. I don't think we'd be having this conversation if that did not happen to Weldon. Mm-hmm. So it wound up as he beats Kurt Weldon. So now he's in the seat for a blank year, two terms, and he decides he doesn't like to be a congressman anymore. He wants to be a senator. We lose that seat to a Republican. So he costs us a Democratic seat that he would have probably kept. We lose that seat. And then the other part of it, and then, you know, Timmy Holden, who was an incumbent, and we have a little bit of a rule, even with the Republican side, that we don't back another Democrat against the Republican. But I mean back, I mean we give him money and mm-hmm. funding. We have a little bit of a rule, even with Republicans and Democrats from Pennsylvania. So Joe Sestak, in his wisdom, ends up backing somebody against a sitting congressman, against Tim Holden, Matt Cartwright, who's a great guy, nice guy, the whole bit, but he had no business doing that. You know, I mean, a little bit of loyalty there. Mm. Next thing he does is that Allison Swartz is running, not for governor, where she's running for a reelect. She had an opponent. She knocked the opponent off the ballot. The opponent now runs as a writing candidate. And lo and behold, Joe Sestak back out there backing that candidate against Allison. I mean, I'm not trying to tell you that we have to have complete structure and people shouldn't do what they do or shouldn't roam with your own, but you have to have some type of loyalty with the people that you served with and the people that helped you. On his reelect, we contributed to his reelect. And then, you know, now he wants to, you know, he wants to now again take another, you know, shot at Toomey. Specter issue, I mean, you know, the president called me himself, the vice president, the governor Rendell at that time, said they can make a move, they can get the, you know, Specter to become a Democrat, and he gave some votes along those lines when he was a Democrat after he switched, and he thought that they thought that he would be the best bet to beat. To beat Toomey. Now, we don't know what would have happened.
I was going to say, you know, it's hard to know how that would have happened or whether he would have been able to beat Pat Toomey. But it sounds like you're saying is that Joe Sestak is not a team player. Now, he calls people like you. I read a quote somewhere that you're the Washington, D.C. Democrats, and he's really interested in the people who are Democrats. I mean, he walked across the state, and he's talking to people about his run for office. Yeah, does that not have an appeal for you?
I kind of think he's his own person because he's a Joe Sestak person and worrying about. I mean, what's wrong with being a member of Congress? I mean, for a while, not just one and a half or two terms. You know, why do you need to, you know, and what about being a little bit of loyal to the people that are kind of like loyal to you and people that you serve with? Mm. You know, and that's my issue and my problem. So he can be his free thinker and a buck what they call the establishment. Well, you know, Katie McKinley, I think, would be a great candidate, and no strings attached. But I think there's some type. You have to have some type of a loyalty. And Sestak said to me along the way sometime that he would sit down and talk before he made his decision. And he went to breakfast a couple times, and he picked my brain, and he wanted me to mentor him, and I did, and I would talk to him about what he had to do and how he had to do and certain things. You know, you don't know what Congress is like until you actually been there for a very long time until you figure it out. You know, and I helped him along the way, and he said he would always talk to me before he ever made any kind of decision. And then the next week or later, he's having a press conference that he's running for the United States Senate and not running for his congressional seat. Again,
so
we lost
personal?
The seat.
Is it personal to you?
It's a lot of things. It's a little bit personal, to be honest with you, yes. And it's a little bit political that, you know, that we lost a seat. And it's a little bit of loyalty that he was against two incumbents that were running for re-election, and he supported both of their Democratic opponents in the primary. One was a writing candidate, which you can hold, you know. And I had a mini conversation with him, and he said, well, there are people that helped him. Well, just because somebody helps you don't mean you got to go out on a limb and go against somebody that's, you know, an incumbent that helped you also. You know, and we signed bills for him. We supported bills that he tried to pass. I'm sure some of them contributed to his reelect. You know, and so it's a lot of things. I guess it's personal, it's political, and it's a little bit of ethical.
Well, and just a couple more questions because we got two guests here, and I see a lot of phone calls as well. Are you a supporter of Katie McGinty, and is she actually going to run? We've been speculating on the air here, but do you know anything, Bob Brady?
No, I don't know. I only know that I talked to a reporter, and a reporter had mentioned her name, and I said I would absolutely be for Katie McGinty if she decided to run. I think she's a very class person. She ran a very classy campaign for governor. Didn't have the money, unfortunately. Nobody wanted to put the money as much as our current governor, but she still was a very class lady, went around, campaigned, and I think she's got a lot of structure, and I think that she would be a great candidate. And I would support her absolutely as hard as I can.
And another question for you, but on an unrelated topic. Should Congressman Shaka Fatah step down? He was indicted yesterday on 29 counts.
It's devastating. It cost me a night's sleep, maybe two. I couldn't sleep all night last night, you know, when we found out about it yesterday. It's just a sad, sad situation. It really is. I just wish him and his family the best. You know, yesterday's like the get out of, you know, school recess, you know, like a summer recess. It's our last day. We've been in for 4 weeks in a row, and we're ready to get out. It's a good day. Everybody's up, and everybody's, you know, happy to, you know, get home and get into our districts and do some district work, let our constituents actually see us instead of, like, you know, reading about us. And it's a good day, and then all of a sudden something like this hit, and it just took took everything out of me. Look, I've known Shaka for 40 years. He was my legislator, my senator, and he was my congressman at one time until redistricting. And I'm crushed by these allegations, and I hope that he can prevail, and I hope that wish him and his family well.
Well, Bob Brady, Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you. You take care.
You too. And he's a congressman representing the 1st Congressional District here in Pennsylvania, also chairman of the city's Democratic Committee, talking about Joe Sestak and Katie McGinty. And we will continue our conversation talking with Tom Baldino and Mark Nevins. I see a lot of comments here. We've got some calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Mark, since you're sitting across from me, anything you want to say? I mean, what we heard from Bob Brady, not on the Shaka Fatah indictments, but just this very personal, not being a team player, not being loyal, how important that is in politics.
Yeah, not surprising at all. I mean, that's what I would have expected him to say. And as he noted, it's a little personal, it's a little political. I mean, Congressman Brady is not only a congressman, but a leader of the party. So I think he has a vested interest in making sure we protect democratically held congressional seats in the region. So I think he feels it on a lot of levels, and clearly that's something that bothers him. But as we said, you know, for Congressman Sestak, that's a winner for him. He can run against the party leaders, he can run against the party establishment, and that may be a winning strategy for him.
Tom, let me read an email we have from Richard. He says, Joe Sestak should have challenged the party's decision to allow Specter to switch. Other than this, is there something Sestak has done to induce such stupidity in the Pennsylvania Democratic Party? And one wonders, Tom, whether there'll be other Richards who will just – they don't care what Bob Brady has to say. They – you know, people are much more independent these days. They're not so loyal to their parties. Whether this could be a problem for the Democratic Party in Pennsylvania?
Yeah. Well, let me just say that there are no rules that prevent the party from encouraging or discouraging. I mean, whatever people think about how parties operate, there are really very few rules that are hard and fast that allow the party to discipline anyone who bucks the party, which is then, if I may extend this line of thinking, the frustration that we heard from Congressman Brady was the kind of frustration that leaders in both parties, nationally and at the state level, feel in this era where anyone with enough money can be a candidate. And we're witnessing that on the national stage with Trump, right? And how in the last presidential cycle, someone like Gingrich and a few others could run with the backing of one or two very wealthy people. Those kinds of candidates challenge the party establishment in a way that is, you know, relatively unprecedented. Mm-hmm. I mean, since modern parties began in this country, and I don't want to get too, again, nerdy here, but you go all the way back to the
we're all about nerdy. Yes, no, go ahead, Tom.
So you go all the way back to the 1800s, and parties, when they formed, structured around organizations that were built on discipline of a kind. But since the modern era and the ability of candidates to raise money and spend money independently of parties, individuals, not just like Joe Sestak, but individuals can declare their candidacy. And, of course, the other thing to trace here is back to the advent – or not advent, but the real importance of primary elections as the vehicle to getting the nomination. So you go back to before 1968, without a party convention or a party endorsement, it was impossible to really win as an independent. But once primaries became the primary mechanism for nominating candidates for the general election, anyone with enough money, independently or otherwise, could get on the ballot. And so, I'll just throw in Citizens United, which allows people to independently of parties form PACs to raise unlimited amounts of money to back candidates. And so you hear in Brady's frustration how he's dealing with Sestak, but this is happening nationally and in other states. So it is from the party's perspective, almost the worst of all possible worlds.
Well, let me throw something else in, Mark, and then we'll get some callers in, which is voters are much more independent, it seems. Yes, there are many more independent voters, and although this is kind of a closed state in many ways, people don't necessarily pull the party line.
Well, it's easier now to get information about candidates than it was years ago, even 10, 15, 20 years ago. A lot of people relied on the party network to pass down information about who was running and who they should vote for, and they had to kind of take their cues from their committee people or their ward leaders. And now with the internet, with the sort of multiple streams of information available to voters, they can educate themselves. They don't need a party leader. They don't need a city committee leader or a ward leader or a committee person to tell them who to vote for. They can go in and figure it out themselves. These have become high information elections. Some of the smaller municipal races are low information elections. People turn out to vote because they always do, and they just vote for whoever's on the ballot that they recognize. But in these sort of U.S. Senate races, governor's races, even congressional races, they become high information elections, and people know enough to figure out for themselves who to vote for.
What's so interesting is looking at some of the email comments, how people are still mad at Arlen Specter. I mean, that switching of – I'm looking at you, Mark, but that switching of parties.
Mad at him for leaving the Republican Party or mad at him for
– I think for playing both sides. People don't like that.
I will tell you that in my experience, the Democrats are much more – reluctant to embrace a Republican who switches parties, whereas Republicans are very quick to embrace Democrats who switch parties. And I think Republicans assume everybody is a Republican at heart, so it's just a matter of time before they switch parties and come home. And Democrats assume that anyone who's trying to be a part of their party must have some sinister notion in mind. So it's a different of sort of party approach to switchers.
Tom, we have a comment from Marta. She says, if McGuinty couldn't win a statewide race, why do they think she can get a Senate seat? And that is, I mean, she's never won elective office. I mean, she's run for things and she's had some pretty high positions within other administrations. But do you see this as a risk on the part of the Democratic Party, Tom?
Oh, absolutely. because she has no electoral track record other than the loss in the gubernatorial Democratic primary, she is something of a high-risk candidate. However, that Democratic gubernatorial primary was a crowded field. And Wolf ran a masterful campaign, investing $10 million and more of his own money early, got out way in front of everyone else with those wonderful – well, I'm wonderful. They were very effective ads, right, that placed him in the minds of the Democratic Party electorate, right, the primary electorate, on issues that were important not just to Democrats but clearly to voters statewide, and that was the education issue. And so it wasn't just McGuinty who lost. I mean, clearly she lost, but there were three other candidates who were very qualified and had some electoral success, and Wolf blew them all away. Mm. So
let me give we only have a minute left, so let me give Mark a chance to weigh in on that.
I just wanted to take a slightly different approach to looking at a McGuinty candidacy should she decide to run. Not having a statewide elected track record could be a positive for her, because when you have votes, when you have taken votes over the course of your career, that's the sort of opposition research your opponents use to blow you up. So not having that kind of track record sort of prevents her from carrying a lot of baggage along with her. And having the party support, as we said, not always as important as it used to be, but look at what happened to Congressman Sestak in his fundraising in the second quarter. He only raised $700,000+, and part of his hurdle, part of his struggle was that he couldn't get that big PAC money, the money that comes in bigger chunks, because the party's not with him. Mm. And Senator Toomey raised $2.2 million in that period. That's a difference that's hard to make up. And if Katie McGuinty has the party support, that money might be there for her. And it's easier for her to try and compete with him for the grassroots support than it is for him to try and compete for the big money.
Well, stay tuned, listeners. Much more to come. My thanks to you, Mark Nevins. Thanks for coming into Radio Times from the Dover Group here in Philadelphia. Tom Baldino, thank you for joining us as well.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're welcome. A professor of political science at Wilkes University in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and sign up for our newsletter. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.